You notice that verse 12 and verse 14 contain a similar admonition, and that is an appeal to the brethren. So these are things that are written to the members of the congregation in the church in Thessalonica that the Apostle Paul wants to stress in trying to help them in their service to the Lord, and in their service to, which in turn relates to their service to one another also. So in verses 12 and 13, we talked about the fact that this was a directive that related to their responsibilities to those that were over them and that labored among them, which the only people that could possibly be would be the elders. Now, since we do not have elders, that would not specifically apply to us, but Lord willing, the day when we are under an eldership, then again, the responsibilities that are spelled out in this verse would apply. But then verse 14, again, we exhort you, brethren. And in this particular verse, these are things that have nothing particularly to do with the oversight of the congregation, but in fact would be applicable to every congregation on the earth where there's more than one person. And of course, by definition, ecclesia is plural. That means you you can't have a congregation of one, but you could have a Christian, but you couldn't have a congregation by definition. But these would, these we know there were several members of the congregation in Thessalonica to whom this, of course, is directed. And the first one we talked about last week, to admonish the disorderly, those that are out of line, this is a military term. And then the second category, is to encourage the faint-hearted. The word encourage there means to stimulate to action. Does that bring to mind any other admonition that you can think of as far as where Christians are told to stimulate one another to action? Doesn't say to action, but Hebrews chapter 10. American Standard says provoke one another to love and good works. I believe the New American Standard says something about stimulate one another to love and good works. And of course, those aren't the only two places where we learn about that. But this is one of our God-given assignments as members of a congregation, is to help to stimulate, motivate, and even the word provoke, although it has some kind of a negative connotation. I remember Brother W. L. Wharton used to say, we do a real good job of provoking one another. But it is a matter of, helping each other along, sort of prodding and doing what we can to stimulate that action. Well, in this case, he says that those who are to be encouraged or stimulated to action are the faint-hearted, is the American Standard rendering. Literally, that term means small, S-O-U-L-E-D, sold. Or some versions say, or literally, some say quitters.
That's what I was going to say, one who is a quitter.
One who is a quitter. Not in the sense of being innately a quitter, but one who is discouraged rather than encouraged, and is either on the verge of, or at least certainly heading in that direction of, throwing their hands up and saying, I can't go any farther. Now, what have we learned about some things that are going on in Thessalonica that would fit into that possibility in that scenario? Why would somebody in Thessalonica be, prone to going down the road of throwing up their hands, quitting? Richard?
Well, they might want to go back to their old pagan ways.
Well, that's a possibility, but what else did we know that Paul's mentioned several times? How about the persecution? They've been, several times he's mentioned that they've endured persecution. Persecution is a huge deterrent to faithfulness. That's why Satan finds it to be such an effective tool. Now, whether or not that is the primary reason for these who are needing encouragement, we don't know, but It is certainly a very real possibility. And I think it's highly, highly probable. What are, Al?
Yeah, mine says comfort the faint-hearted, mm-hmm. which is going along with what you're saying here. If they're persecuted, you need to comfort them too, as they're being persecuted.
Okay.
I don't know if that is saying encourage.
Let's see, I remember seeing something about that particular word. Let me see. Well, I read it somewhere else. It's not either one of these. I would have to look, we'd have to look up to do a word study on that, look up the thought. The word comfort, the word comforter, as a matter of fact, for example, it's used in 1 John chapter 1, literally means to come to the side of one as an aid. So if that's the same word here, and I suspect that it is, that's still the idea of coming near a person to help them and encourage them. So, say I don't recall what that word is, but here, but I think it's the word that's usually translated by our English word comfort in many places. Okay. Anybody else? What might be some of the reasons? Again, today, thinking about the applicability of this to us in 2000 and almost 15, I start thinking a number higher, don't we, after tonight? Help me out. Well, what are some obstacles that might we might have to face that would cause us to? I mean, not us particularly in this room, but some of our brethren that might need encouraging to want to quit.
Illness.
Well, that's, you could get to that point, yeah.
Well, I mean, some people use their illness as possibly an excuse to be not as faithful as they could be.
Well, that can certainly happen. Yeah, that can certainly happen. Not to diminish the impact of serious illness in a person's life, but there are some people that use that for an excuse.
You miss a few services and then you kind of get into the routine of not coming because of one health problem or another.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, you don't even think of coming. So that's a possibility.
What about external pressures put upon folks by the culture and or other people. Did I say Andrew? Yes, Cheryl.
False teaching. I mean, if people come to a service and they hear not the truth being spoken and they know what the truth is, then they figure they can read the Bible themselves and get just as much out of it.
Well, that can happen too. Yeah, that can happen too. What about the general pervasiveness of immorality and ungodliness and irreligion? Is that something that can have a negative impact upon people's commitment to the Lord and fire and zeal and so forth? Rick?
I've seen some churches where as time goes on, some of the stronger members either retire and move away or pass away, and the whole commitment to the truth kind of goes by the wayside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a subtle device of Satan that, and he's very patient. Over time, he can gradually just sort of desensitize and people to the point that they're not as zealous for the truth, and again, those that are, that, like you say, either they die or whatever, and pretty soon you've got this sort of, well, we talked about the Sunday morning, the Laodicean church, the lukewarm. Yeah. So there's a lot of things, again, that if we who are strong, remember the strong are charged with the responsibility of encouraging the weak, need to be attuned to that, the people that we can help, the people that perhaps are, you know, a little less or a little weaker than we might, we might be. Which leads to the next admonition. not the next one. Support the weak. Now, the English word support is kind of like, you know, think about propping somebody up, propping something up. You know, it's a support. In the original, this particular word literally clears it with the idea of sticking with. So it's more the idea of helping the other, you know, other person along and standing beside them. And giving them the necessary encouragement that they wouldn't feel like that they're going it alone. And then he concludes that in that verse, be long suffering toward all.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, can you think of one that would be germane to the situation in Corinth? I mean, not Corinth, but Thessalonica.
Well, even just like when Andrew studied the coming of the Lord.
The second coming, yeah.
For those that were, you know, they were expecting to run away. Mm-hmm. And then when he doesn't come, you know, doesn't know he's going to come, it caused him to be the weak.
Mm-hmm.
So ready to.
Right. You know, that's true. Yes. Maybe some of their friends or relatives die, because that, you know, that was a question about, well, what about these people that die? And if that's the case, they may be thinking, well, you know, again, I'm going to miss out. You know, so that could be something that would be attacking their faith.
Also consider weakness in people that are discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we get a very strong Christian. Things right now, and that causes them to be not so much, maybe not just with the church, but with other
Yeah, Satan has a whole arsenal that he can use and attack from many different directions. Just about the time you think Satan's run out of bullets, it seems like he gets a new supply and something else. And yeah. Right. And so the weakened or those that need encouraging are not, like you say, not necessarily either new converts or people that, you know, whose faith is in question, but, you know, just everything getting piled on. It can be overwhelming sometimes. And we're all susceptible to it. And it could be a variety of different things. Al?
It's, with all of these, it's all about attitude. But if your attitude is you're willing to do something, or you're willing to do things for the Lord, it's hard for Satan to get to you. But sometimes your attitude can change a little bit because of some of these things that's going on. It can make you weak, and he can get to you.
I see two different groups whose attitude is in view here. That is two different categories, I say. Do you?
The person that has the problem
and the person that has that needs to respond to the problem. Again, not any particular congregation involved, but just in a general sense, my observation has been through the years that there is a great shortage of the people who are eager to jump in there and attend to the problem that other people are having, the needs. It's my considered opinion that the more people who do express it, and I'm not talking about just, you know, smothering somebody, but the more people who are involved in helping to encourage the faint-hearted, support the weak, be long-suffering towards all, et cetera, et cetera, the greater the impact is going to be, and the easier it is for those who are striving to do that to bear the load, because the load is getting spread out. You know, if it's just one or two people, the load can sometimes become overwhelming. You know, Paul said in Galatians chapter 6, bear ye one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Burden bearing is a monumental task, but it's not an option. You know, we have got, again, it's a command, but it's made easier the more there are involved in it. Now, I just think about, Sharon and the people, several people that are helping with her. I don't think one person could do it all. It would be not impossible, but it would be a huge, huge task. And this is not her fault. It's just that, Satan, like I say, has just piled so much on her. And just in case you didn't know, January 29th, I think, is going to be a huge day. That's when she has the next court appearance. And she's anticipating, I think, some things that may not happen. We don't know what's going to happen. It's all in the hands of the judge, and it's the same judge, and that does not portend very well for the potential outcome. But, we all of us need to be mindful of that, not only in our prayers, but also in the support that she needs. She's got a remarkable attitude. But let me assure you, that beneath that is a lot of pain and a lot of apprehension, and justifiably so. So just remember that. I mean, this is a perfect example of what Paul's talking about here in 1 Thessalonians 5:14. Any other thoughts on that, or this, or the subject? Again, talking about what these people in the church need to be thinking about doing, it seems almost odd until you really stop and try to connect the dots that verse 15 would be thrown in here. See that none render unto anyone evil for evil. Or some versions, literally the idea is don't take vengeance on somebody. Well, now, okay. In light of what we've said and some possibilities that we've alluded to, who might be the ones that were either the object of or the ones that were doling out the vengeance or felt like that they were justified in taking vengeance on somebody? What about the persecutors? If somebody does something, you know, it's that, oh, if they do it to me, I've got a right to do something back to them, especially if it's, again, if it's unjustified, if it's totally spurious, you know, that there's no reason whatsoever for them to be doing that to me, then, again, our culture says, well, then, you just give them a taste of their own medicine. And Paul says, no, you don't. No, we don't. In Romans, you remember, he describes metaphorically the attitude that a person is to have who has an inclination to want to get to render vengeance to those that have unjustly treated him. You remember how he describes that? Betty? Yeah, but in that same context, he says something else about what you do to the person. Heap coals of fire on their head. In other words, you just overwhelm them with love. It's kind of like pouring a bucket of hot coals on somebody's head and to get their attention, like, wow, I can't believe that. You know, I realize that's not the exact terminology, but he does say, If thine enemy, this is verse 20 of Romans 12, but if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he's thirst, give him to drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Which, I get the picture there of, you know, his conscience is going to be bothering him. It's going to be kind of burning a little bit. Like, why are they being nice to me? Because I was so mean to them. And that's what Paul says to do. You know, and again, in that same text, he says, you know, the Lord says, you know, that he's going to take care of this matter of vengeance. Betty?
Now, the verse before is talking about brethren, you know, treating what you did to your brethren. So in this verse, is that speaking of people on the outside? See, that's what to me seems strange when this is put in here. You're thinking about your brethren that you don't repay anybody.
Well, you know, the object is not specifically stated, but verse 15, see that none, the understood object of that phrase is none of you. Okay? Render unto anyone. So I would lean in the direction of to the members of the congregation there, anybody that you feel like you have the right to take vengeance against, which would certainly fit the scenario of those that were persecuting them or anybody else on the outside. Of course, it applies that you wouldn't take vengeance against your brother, but it fits the whole picture better if he's talking to the Christians about not taking vengeance on those that are causing them the problems, which would be people on the outside. There, let me say one other thing about that, because that is one thing that sometimes the commentators say. Well, you know, they were fussing and fighting one another. To me, the strongest argument against that is that we know when people were fussing and fighting in a congregation, Paul jumped on that like, you know, like a cat on a June bug. And, you know, Corinth is a good example of that. If that's what was going on in Thessalonica, then the big question mark is, why didn't Paul specifically jump on that and say something about it? I think that's a good argument that was not the problem in Thessalonica, that the real problems in Thessalonica were more from the outside than the inside. Paul?
Last part of 15, want to say
that. Yep, it does.
Among yourselves, he says there, whatever call it, which is good, both among yourselves and you all.
Right.
So that's everybody else.
Yeah, two groups, yourselves and all the rest of all those folks. Yeah, thank you, good point. It's time for a break, a throat break. I just want to say something while I'm... Ken?
Well, this is, you know, not having, doling out evil for evil, sometimes a tough concept to deal with in today's world, and I'm sure in the first century as well. Because if you think about it, that thought is so prevalent in the world, and it's so opposite of what Christ teaches. It's, to me, it's the weak position to take.
Mm-hmm.
The one who can forgive has the much stronger, therefore, or stronger in the faith, really, position. And it's, you know, when you hear about these crimes, these horrendous crimes, and then the victim or the victim's family says, "I forgive this person for what they've done." You know, that's in the past, and let's move on. I often wonder, how in the world can they do that? Even though, you know, back in my, at the right side of my brain says, that's the right thing to do. You think that so much has been put upon them. How do they forgive somebody that's done that to them? But that is from a position of power, more powerful.
I didn't see the movie, and I don't really intend to since I've read the book. But Louis Zamperini, you talk about being able to forgive somebody. How in the world he could go to those people who did such horrendous things to him and tell them that he forgave them is astounding. It's astounding. If you haven't read the book, I urge you to do so. I don't want to... You know, now, from what I've read of the reviews of the movie, they did a real lousy job of portraying the events of his life. But, you know, that the movie in the book is unbroken. But I do highly recommend the book. It's a just stupendous story of how a person can, if they want to. Forgive for the most horrific treatment. Scott.
The thing I like about that book so much is that it brings out how they prayed when they're on that raft. They really prayed to God.
Yeah.
And they said that they were rescued, they served God, and gave their life to God.
Yeah, the sad thing is that it was Billy Graham religion instead of, you know, New Testament Christianity. But he certainly made up his mind that he was going to change his life. Yeah.
I was thinking about Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15. Hebrews 12, 15. Or 14, verse 15. It says, "Follow after peace with all men, and the sanctification without which no man shall see the Lord, looking carefully." three must there be any man that falls short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness bring up trouble you, and thereby the many will be defiled.
And of course, the comparison that he makes there is to Esau, who was who considered that which was of value useless, vain. That's a similar admonition. It doesn't seem to parallel what was going on in Thessalonica, because Paul has continually commended them for their faith. And so, you know, the Hebrew writer is talking about those that whose faith is, you know, on the verge of disappearing. Now, of course, that would potentially happen to those that, you know, were weak and quit and so forth. So there would be a parallel there. Let's move on here. I want to see if we can wrap this, probably wrap this up this evening. And Brother Cantrell has already pointed out there that what they need to be doing is following after. That is, this is continuing action. Keep on, keep on, keeping on. That which is good, not only towards one another, but also, you know, toward all. Then, it says, rejoice always. And again, this is, you know, keep on, keeping on, keeping on, rejoicing. Well, again, if it's tied in with things like persecution and other things that are threatening their faith, that raises the question, well, so what really is the source of joy in a Christian's life? Is it circumstances and events of the day or week or month or year? Exactly. Exactly. Which is the opposite of people's perception of where joy comes from, which is, you know, the things of this world and the events of their life that are mundane, not spiritual. But, you know, again, given what we know about Thessalonica, not only the persecution, but also the obstacles of the paganism and the Judaism and the commercial enterprise that was so rife with you know, fraud and ungodliness and, you know, all the other things that went along with that. Well, that would again make the Christians at Thessalonica, who were, you know, a relatively small percentage of the populace there, think, wow, we're outnumbered. You know, we're just a little of us here, and the world, whole world's against us. No. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing. This is an oft-cited passage. I've used it a bazillion times, but probably not in the context that it needs to be framed with. Praying. Well, think, you know, help me out here. Some things to pray about that fit in with the context of the statement.
Mm-hmm. And that the relationship that we have with one another as brethren.
Right.
And the salvation that comes through keeping on, keeping on.
Mm-hmm. All right. Betty?
Mm-hmm. I've got verse 12 praying for the elders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else? All the above? Okay.
Should cause
rejoicing. Right. And which is the next and in everything giving thanks. Well, again, all to be thankful for. Again, you know, number one, the spiritual relationship that you have with the Lord, and then the the privilege of helping others, the privilege of being the example in the midst of opposition and persecution. You think about 1 Peter chapter 2. Verse 18 and following. Servants, being subjected to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. For this is acceptable if for conscience toward God a man endureth grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when you sin you are buffeted, or if you shall take it patiently, but when you do well and suffer for it, you shall take it patiently. This is acceptable with God. And of course, you know, in right back in verse 13, he talks about the influence that you're going to have upon others. And back up in verse 12, have your behavior seemly among the Gentiles, that wherein they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they behold glorify God in the day of visitation. So the example that we set in dealing with all the adversity cannot be overstated. It is so important. And it's not just so we can pat ourselves on the back and say, "Whoa, look how tough I was." No, but by our genuine dedication to doing what is right, and exhibiting that in our lives with our thanksgiving and our joy and our whole life, our whole demeanor, that's a profound statement to the world about the difference between living as a Christian and living the ways of the world. For this is the will of God in Christ Jesus to you. This is the way God intended for it to be. This is not. This is all by design. It's not by accident. He put us here in the world that we're in and the circumstances that we're in to be a light. And that ought to be enough to grab our attention. Which then leads to the next thought, and that is quench not the Spirit. Quench not literally means to, you know, pour water on, put it out, put out the fire. What could happen, again, give me a scenario here in the light of the context, that would put out the fire of the Spirit. Maybe we ought to first define what, again, we're using metaphors, what that fire of the Spirit would be. Which has impacted, I mean, remember what Paul said about these Christians in Thessalonica from the outset, how they had accepted that word and what a tremendous change it had made in their lives. So, if that was set aside, then the impact of the word, the Spirit-inspired word upon these people's lives would, in effect, be quenched, wouldn't it? It'd be like, again, dumping a bucket of water on a fire. Well, no, don't do that. Let the word keep on working in you. Let the Spirit's word keep on working in you, which is going to reinforce your commitment to do these things that Paul has said. Despise not prophesying. Yeah, of course, you can go to 1 Corinthians 14, you can spend a lot of time talking about what all that might be. I'm not so sure that this has to do with spiritual gifts. One thing that comes to mind is what had been said prophetically about the return of the Lord and or by the teachers and by Jesus himself about the return of the Lord, which seems to be a big issue in the church there. Now, it could be entirely possible. It could be that some who had the spiritual gift of prophesying were being sort of snubbed or, you know, looked down on or whatever. I don't know. You know, Betty?
The New American says prophetic utterances, which kind of...
Yeah, that's their sort of editorialization of what they think it's talking about. And it could be. I don't know. Paul?
I look back at it where it says, quench not the spirit. I have a problem there with the idea that we have a capitalized S in that spirit, too. I mean, their attitude, what their whole attitude is to get the gospel out to people. They're spoken of influencing all of Macedonia and Achaia and everything else. He said, don't stop that attitude. Keep that attitude going. Keep that whole thing, situation going.
Could be.
And in doing that, then because if you stop it, you don't let that spirit of evangelism stop it. To me, that's what it's talking about.
Could well be. Now, somebody earlier had mentioned false teaching, which that seems to fit into verse 21, and that is prove all things. You know, determine what's right, what's true, and what's false. Well, that also goes along with what Paul just said about, the spreading of the word and prophesying and all that. Bottom line is, again, hold fast to what's good. Hang on to what's good and discard what's bad. Well, the only way you're going to know the good from the bad is to put it to the test. And the way you put it to the test is by the word, which is the standard. And then abstain from every form of or kind of or of evil. I know preachers do it, so I guess I'm guilty of making a broad brush application of that verse in the context. Certainly it seems to me that it would particularly apply to the admonition of verse 21, which is to put things to the test. And then whenever you figure out the good from the bad, then abstain from the bad things. In any shape, fashion, or form. Well, bad teachings, false teachings, etc.
So much in the world is said, and people just blindly go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what the scriptures teach us is to not do that in any context, but to test what's being said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You just did what everybody did. But now you do. So now you have the responsibility to test that standard and to use it.
Yes. Now, again, if you stay on the right path and you do everything that that Paul has said to do here, doesn't mean you've earned your salvation. But what it means is that you're talking about a description of a person who fully trusts in the Lord and the salvation that's in Christ. And again, in view of the return of the Lord, the bottom line is that, verse 23, and the God of peace himself shall sanctify you wholly, completely, and may your spirit, soul, and body be preserved entire without blame at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. In other words, you're on the right path that's going to take you to the desired end result of your life when the Lord returns. Now, the people who go crazy on the soul and the body and the spirit, particularly the soul and the spirit, like to jump on this verse and say, okay, there's three things that make up a person: soul, body, and spirit. And then they get into a big fuss over what's the difference between soul and spirit. Well, whatever the difference is, it doesn't really matter because I don't know for sure. I do know that the word soul is used to just describe life, you know, he breathed into his nostrils the rest of life, man became a living soul, Genesis says. And spirit being that part of us that doesn't die in the body. But I don't think that that's Paul's point. I think Paul's point is that just then your entire person, everything about you, all that there is that makes up Ken Dart, and of course we make the decision in our mind to use our bodies in the best way we possibly can in serving the Lord, and at the end of time when the Lord comes, or that's the point that we're looking at is the time of ultimate reward, then you're going to be ready to hear him say, enter into the joy of thy Lord, well done, good and faithful servant. And so to make this mean any more than that, I think, is to go beyond what the apostle intended. And then, verse 24, faithful is he that calleth you, who will also do. The word it is supplied by the translators. Who will do. In other words, you can do it. You can do it. Because look who's on your side. God is. The one who is the great doer. You do your part, he does his part, you win. Brethren, pray for us. Well, I can't remember. There's five or six or seven times that Paul encourages the brethren to pray for him and his companions. He understands the power of prayer. He started out this epistle talking about his prayers for them, and he certainly appreciates their prayers on his behalf. And then, of course, the salutation, I mean the conclusion. Salute all the brethren with a holy kiss. Word salute here, just a common, like we would say, tell everybody hello for us. This is nothing formal. It's just a common term for greeting. And then, one thing that is interesting is, in verse 27, I adjure you. The word adjure there means this is crucial. This is important. This is an absolute necessity. It's not like, oh, and then when you get around to it, be sure and read this to everybody. No. This is an absolute must. Read this epistle. I adjure you by the Lord that this epistle be read unto all the brethren. Everybody needs to hear this. Everybody in the church in Thessalonica, obviously. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. Powerful, powerful words. That, again, that last chapter is one that... The whole last part of it is a refrigerator door posting. So utterly practical and relevant to us today, even though it was written to those in Thessalonica 2,000 years ago. Well, we've got 28 or 9 seconds left before the classes come in. Any final thoughts on this evening that you might have, or observations? Scott?
The ESV, for verse 27, it says, I put you under all. It says, I adjure you. It says, I put you under all. And the Paul can tell you, the King James says, I charge you.
Right. Yeah, this, again, it's like an order. Yeah. It's not, he wants them to understand that this is crucial. because he's deeply concerned about them. He's mentioned that several times already. Anything else? Well, I guess you know where we're going next. In my Bible, you don't even have to turn the page. You just look over to the next side, the right side. I'll tell you right now, I don't know how much time there is between 1 and 2 Thessalonians. The best guess is a fairly short period of time. But we don't know. And there's absolutely nothing that I know of, unless you find it, be sure and bring the information next week. That tells us exactly when Paul got the information or how he got the information that he writes about in 2 Thessalonians. He obviously got it, but who, how, or when, I don't believe we're told. But we don't have to be to know that it's the Word, the Lord, that he's writing to. So all those kinds of questions that commentators like to spend a couple of chapters writing about don't matter, apparently. If they did, we'd be told about it.